Welcome to the Intersectionality Lab, a fair space to explore intersections.
Hello and welcome to another episode. With me today is Anna Katharina, and this episode is an unfiltered one. That means it's an informal conversation between the two of us. And today we want to talk about bodily autonomy. And before we start, we would like to give a short definition that of what we mean when we talk about bodily autonomy. And I mean, there are many definitions, and we use this one because for us it was the most inclusive one, and it is from the material of the AIDS and Rights Alliance of Southern Africa. And I will just read it out so we know that we are all on the same page before we start. So after this definition, bodily autonomy is as understood as the essential freedom to make your own decisions in relation to your body. It is the ability to exercise complete agency over your body, freedom, free from external interference, social and legal sanctions, coercion, violence or discrimination, and discriminations, of course. Key to this is the notion of choice. In the context of sexual and reproductive health and rights, it includes the freedom to make autonomous decisions about your gender expression, your identities, and about your sexuality, including when, whether, with whom, or how to have sex and feel pleasure. It includes the freedom to decide whether to have children, with whom, and how many children to have. It is the freedom to make decisions about your sexual and reproductive health. So this is kind of the definition we choose for this episode. And maybe to start the conversation, I would start with a short question for you, Anna Katharina. So within this definition and many movements of bodily autonomy, the sentence or the quote, "My body is my own," is referred a lot or used a lot. And I would like to ask you, in your experience, when was the first time you came across this experience or the sense of "my body is my own"?
Wow, that's a super interesting question. So first of all, hi everybody. And to say that I really love this definition. We went back and forth with the definition that we wanted to use. So I think that "my body is my own," it came from a less pleasant experience when I was younger, but it's a funny one. But I understood that something was not right. So here in Portugal, it's super common for small children to be made to kiss people when they meet. And I was with my grandmother, and I had like some chubby cheeks. So and she introduced me to one of her friends that basically like just wanted to kiss my cheeks and like pinch my cheeks. And I was just like with this funny feeling that I was being like overly held and kissed, and that made me feel like not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And the major point that I felt was to run away, basically, and that's what I did. And my grandma just like went all red because I just like ran and put myself under the bed and refused mm-hmm. to come out until that lady went away. Yeah. So of course I didn't have the notion that this was body autonomy, but it was the first time that I felt that somebody was using or invading my space, and in this mm-hmm. sense my body, even if it's something really seemingly innocent as like kissing mm-hmm. a child or pinching their cheeks, right? But in a more organized way of thinking and accessing that "my body, my choice" was probably when I entered adolescence and when I started to go out at night, and probably when men mm-hmm. would like touch me in the way that probably in my waist or something like that I would not like. Mm-hmm. And it's quite funny because my friends basically told me that I developed a certain eye, which I would give men that would put them on their place. They call it my 31 look. Because because I think it was, they thought it was super funny because, like, just like for me to like raise my eyebrow and just like would like put them away. So yeah, basically it was in my adolescence that I have like this like conscious and articulated thinking behind no one can touch my body unless I say so.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And about you, and what about you? Also,
yeah, because I was thinking, I think for a very long time I didn't have this sense of my body as my own, because for example I danced until I was 18, from the age of four until I was 18. So for me it was quite common that people would touch my body to kind of correct your positions and also comment on your body, which I found, and also like, I mean, you're used to or you're exposed to comments of your family, of members or like some relatives that are commenting on your body. And I think especially for young women or girls, it's quite common, and was not nothing I ever noticed as like an interference of my private space. And when I started to go into puberty, of course the body and the body image gets more sensitive, and then I started to bother, like when people told me about the body or your food behavior or eating behavior or whatever. So, and I think the very first, looking for me, looking back, the first notion of like, this is my body, I can decide on my own body, is after I refused taking the contraceptive pill. Because for me it was also like, my mother said like, okay, now you're in the age, you can just take it and then you're safe. So I never questioned it, and the gynecologist never talked with me about other options or explained me or gave me knowledge about sexuality at all. For me it was just like a given to just take the contraceptive pill when I was 14 or 15. I never questioned anything because also my mother told me to do. And then like when I grew older and had issues with that and I didn't want to take it anymore, then I started to get like this from a lot of gynecologists, and I changed the gynecologist every time. They said like, this is the best option you have, there is no other option. I was like, no, then you're not my gynecologist anymore. And I think this was the first starting point of like, this is my body, I decide, and I don't want to take it anymore. So then I refused to go to this gynecologist anymore. And then of course, like after this started, I'm still, I think, more in the process of like how many dimensions and areas of your life are affected and still are, where people take decisions over your body, and sometimes also from a political perspective and societal perspective, and how deeply rooted these interferences are.
I do agree with you, because I had a similar experience that you had with the gynecologist. So I have SPO. So what's the name?
Post-ovarian syndrome.
Yes, I always remember the Portuguese acronym, right? And the pill, it was just like given to me at 16 as medicine for the syndrome that I had, right? It was not discussed with me that I could manage, because we always manage the SPO. We never are cured, right? So it's chronic. Mm-hmm. And it was the only thing that was given to me to manage all of the symptoms, when in fact other countries that do some kind of study, so this is an area that is not really super studied, they start with lifestyle choices, so introducing other kinds of foods, exercise, etc., etc. And I had a super bad reaction to the pill, and like I had this huge fight with my doctor, because I was just like, I'm having headaches, I'm having nausea, I'm having all of the secondary symptoms. And her response was just like, so, but you don't want to take it? And I just like want to have other alternatives. And I felt mm-hmm. pressured by the physicians that I had to take the pill, right? And we can see that even in the medical sense, even when you as a woman need to have some tests, right, some gynecologist tests, it's super rare the doctor who does not explain first the procedure or ask permission to make it, right?
Yes.
And that's because I think that also this comes from like a belief that we have have that if we are in the hands of doctors, they are all powerful because they are treating something or they are discovering something. Mm-hmm. And we forget that we do have autonomy and we do have rights. The right to be explained to what the procedure is and to ask permission for. Of course, if you are in the situation that it's like life-threatening, that's not something mm-hmm. that we can have more leeway on that. But when we are just like managing stuff and it's a condition that is probably chronic like this, of course you have all of the autonomy, all of the rights that you have to ask questions and to make questions, and then for them to ask permission to approach you. Right.
Yeah, but I think for this, you also need to have the knowledge and also unbiased information to ask questions. Because, like, I mean, you start having questions if you have an idea of, for example, your chronic disease or other options that you have. And it's not just, for example, in your case, the contraceptive pill. But I mean, this is already a step further that you have the power and agency to ask questions, to stand in for yourself and to decide whether it's a good treatment or not, or however. But I think the first step is always that you have the knowledge, or that you are provided by the knowledge. For example, if you talk about contraceptive options, that you have the knowledge and the access to what is contraception, what is pregnancy, how you get pregnant, and all this stuff, because this is kind of the base. And then from that point, you can start taking informed decisions, which means that you're stepping in for your body as well.
I do agree with you. I think, like, for me, especially for me, body autonomy was it was self-thought. It was not something that was, except for one stance. So I was brought up by my dad, and one thing that he always told me is nobody has the right to touch you in the way that mm-hmm. you do not want. But he was thinking from a sexual violence point of view, that women normally have are more prone to, right, to receive. So I was not thinking, when he taught me this, he was not thinking on all of the dimensions that we are thinking about this, right? Because, for example, we are thinking about, well, I started like explaining when I was a little girl the story with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. For me, super important to teach body autonomy to children, to prevent things, for example, like pedophiles, like, and grooming of small children. Once they know that they own their own bodies, it's mm-hmm. more difficult for other people to abuse them, right? And that I think it needs to come from the parents. So the parents need to have also this kind of education for them to teach their own children about this.
Yeah. And I think, as you just said, especially, for example, in sexual abuse or kind of physical abuse, gaining bodily autonomy also means kind of being able to escape kind of the abusive situation, or maybe even if you're not having been able to escape it in the moment, but in the sense of like after the traumatization, and you can at one point release this, that it wasn't your fault, because you can decide on your body and you feel something invaded your personal space and was abuse in your sense, however it is defined, that you in the healing process or in the recovery process, you can also escape from this victimhood of abuse and also then reclaim your personal freedom again.
Yeah, I do agree with you. For me, that's a perfect definition between victim and survivor. So for me, the survivor, it's the one who reclaims the power that was taken from you. And when we talk about body autonomy, we need to actually see all of these dimensions that you so well put it at in the beginning, on all of these ramifications that we have on body autonomy. Either it's medical, either it's like giving body autonomy to small children in your sexuality and all of that. But one of the things that for me worries me the most as a grown woman today, it's the movements that are being created against the right of having a medical assisted abortion. Mm-hmm. Right? This is, for me, it's super worrying, because I'm from a time when we did not have this access, and I know mm-hmm. the number of deaths for women who did perform abortions in a clandestine way and what improved after the law was passed, right? So this is like, of course, it's body autonomy. It's a right of for a woman to choose, but it's mm-hmm. also a public health concern, right? It's like an area where these two things like linked yep. together, right? Because when we, I think like the majority of people, when we talk about the issue of abortion, forget one thing. We are not imposing the abortion on anybody. We are giving it mm-hmm. chance for those who need it, because no woman is going to make an abortion with like a clear and like light mind. Like mm-hmm. you have a lot of emotional issues behind it, a lot of emotions behind that decision. It's not something that is done lightly, right? So mm-hmm. it's needed for like whatever the reason is, right, to have access to this safe way of doing it, right, and have that body autonomy to do it, to choose for their own lives, right? So yep. I think like this thing that is also a public health concern, also it's also included on the body autonomy issue, right? I don't know. I'm talking yes. a lot of this, but I really would like to listen no. to your perspective on this.
I absolutely agree that, especially because I don't know why, but I grew up in Germany with the thinking of course you can abort and you can end a pregnancy at any doctor's and it's nothing. I mean, of course it's difficult and it's a personal decision, but somehow. And then at one point I found out that in Germany it's decriminalized and not even legalized. And I mean, in Portugal you have the situation that it's legal, but still even the laws that kind of allow abortion, they allow abortion for a certain type of people, which is usually cis women, and it excludes all other people that are able to be pregnant or have the pregnancy organs or the reproductive organs to get pregnant. And also, for example, if it's decriminalized or even illegalized in a country, it's also a matter of who has the money to travel to a country where it's legalized. So it's again, it's very it distributes between different categories and characteristics of people. And it's not even fair if there is a law that supports usually cis women to abort in a safe way.
Cis rich woman or cis women
cis rich,
with
yes.
access to money, of yeah. course.
And then even if the law, in my experiences from also people around me that had abortions in Portugal, it is legal and you can access it, which is already a very high level compared to other regions of the world. But still, they had to face a lot of stereotyping, a lot of not even passive-aggressive, active-aggressive aggressive behavior from nurses, from doctors, yes. or whatever. So it's not still, I mean, yeah, you can do it, but what are you facing in taking in the decision about your own body? For me, this is
that's a valid discussion to have it, and it's a super important discussion to have. I actually would love to hear the reasoning behind it from like a doctor or a nurse behind it, that idea, because some doctors in Portugal can refuse to make the procedure in the mm-hmm. on the moral grounds, right? And
but this is legal?
Yes,
to refuse?
Yes, they can. They can invoke, I don't know the expression in English, but they can invoke a moral ground, which mm-hmm. they are not comfortable to make the abortion. So basically, and I don't think from, I don't know, it's not, I don't think it's, I don't know from like an ethical point of view, if their refusal mm-hmm. does not contradict the oath that they make as a doctor, right? Because these yep. women, if they are not receiving it legally, they are going to do it clandestinely, right? So they are mm-hmm. they are going to access, it's not even cares, but they are putting their lives in danger. So they may not have a direct link to a possible danger situation for those women, but they are they morally responsible for everything that went mm-hmm. wrong with the abortion if they don't open the space, the safe space for women to have it. Yeah, the name is conscious objector. So Portuguese doctors mm-hmm. can claim conscientious, can be conscientious objectors of producing the procedure. And we do have, namely in more conservative areas of Portugal, doctors who want to give this service to women, but they are arrested by mm-hmm. the population, and they need to stop mm-hmm. the procedure and send people, for example, from the islands to the continent and all of that, so women can access this procedure. But apart from that, of course, and my reasoning is, if you have this from a legal point of view, if you have this as a legal point of view, that they can like be conscientious objectors, of course you will have all of the nuances that you talked about, being passive aggressive, mm-hmm. being cast in stereotypes and all of that by the medical community. And believe me, I know wonderful doctors and wonderful nurses that are pro, but of course we also have that majority that is, I don't know if it is a majority, but I believe from the newspapers and from the data that normally comes out, that it's hand in hand. So you do have access, but you have all of these hurdles that you need to go through to access.
Yeah, I also had a conversation with a nurse who's working in an, how do you say, where you kind of abortion area in the hospital where you can go and access abortion or ask for abortion. And she told me that within this ward, kind of, everyone is pro-abortion, of course, because otherwise they wouldn't work there, and they try to provide a very neutral, if they do is something questionable, but kind of neutral and sensitive way of approaching the people who come there. But the problem is all the time they interfere with other areas in the hospital. The patients are sometimes facing, or most of the times are facing, prejudice, because they know why the people are there and from which ward they're coming, and that it is an issue that they are pro-abortion, but not the whole hospital and not the whole society, just because it's legal. So it was really interesting for me. Yeah, it's very difficult. And
in other, how many? So we've discussed children, we've discussed abortion, we've discussed other medical procedures. Which other areas do you see body autonomy in what is the place that they should have in society?
The first thing, also kind of related to sexuality, is bodily autonomy is also partnerships. And that often it is assumed that, for example, if you are in a whatever kind of form of partnership, or you had sex or had any sexual intercourse with a person, that it's kind of okay that the person is allowed to touch you again, or to, in any occasion, to kind of, you are available since you did it once. Kind of like, this is the mindset. I'm not saying that I'm practicing it, but it's more like the mindset of, like, since, for example, you had a one-night stand, and then it's kind of, and you met this person again, and then it's normal that the person can touch you again without permission or without asking again. I don't know. We had in university, like, this talking about consent and this metaphor of this cup of tea. Only because you had once a cup of tea with a person doesn't mean the next time the person will drink a cup of tea again with you. So for me, it was surprisingly that, of course, consent is also a very important part of bodily autonomy.
Yeah. And actually, that makes me think about something that I don't think that is even recognized by law, which is marital rape.
In Germany, it is since 1997.
Okay, that's nice.
But just to give an example, one of the candidates, I don't want to name, for the presidential election now, or for the new federal elections, he was one in the 90s who voted against legalizing rape in marriage. But he's now, I mean, he's also against abortion and this kind of stuff, but he's the one candidate for federal elections.
Yeah.
Just a side note.
but it's super interesting because we are seeing multiple dimensions of body autonomy and how other issues are connected to it, right?
Yeah. And especially this idea that men in power, especially men in power, can decide in the forms of laws, in kind of more like political discussions, still talk about the bodies of other people, and especially women, trans, like queer people, a lot of like who's deciding and so on. So like all these discussions, and if you, how do you say that? I mean, for a long time, it was also you had to see three different therapists that they say you have body dysphoria and you can change your gender legally and this kind of stuff. I mean, this is since this year, luckily they changed it, but still, like, why do we allow other people to take decisions for us about our bodies?
Or telling us what our bodies are.
I mean, we are the experts of our bodies, no? I mean, we're supposed to be.
Yeah.
But then it's also very difficult because you are taught since the very, very beginning how you, your body has to be, how you have to be, how you have to act inside of your body, how you feel pleasure, how you feel desire, how you express desire, and so on. So I think it's also very, very difficult to step out of it.
But I think in that sense, I think it's equal for men and for women. So it's something that it's imposed. Of course, women, and of course, in this sense, I mean cis women and trans women, right? And non-binary people are the ones who are on the stick of the smaller, wood. So they are the ones who are at the receiving end of what it is and what's not, right? What it is to be a woman, how you should cross your legs, and of course for me that also enters in the camp of body autonomy, of course, interconnected with a lot of other people. But like, and for women especially, it's like a double-edged sword, because you have to be modest, but you also have to be sexy, you have to be this, but you also have to be that, and although people are not touching your body directly, there mm-hmm. are inputting ideas on what your body should be, right? Like yes. you were expressing yourself when you were like a dancer. So what you eat, how you present your body, how, all of this mm-hmm. stuff, right? And I think that also enters in body autonomy. I have the autonomy to dress yes. my body and present my body like the way that I want, right?
I mean, of course, there are laws in some countries to criminalize cross-dressing, especially for trans women or non-binary people. That, I mean, you are free to express your gender or whatever, or your physical appearance, as long as you stay in this gender role perspective or expectations. But as soon as you step out, you are not able to freely express yourself anymore, or you face a lot of discrimination and exclusion, or even penalties. Yeah,
I've seen people being penalized. Yes.
But, sounds weird.
Yeah, but yeah. even if you don't have it, you are some. You have societal pressure. Yeah. For example, one of the things that it makes me like my skin crawl. Basically, it's like listening to people. But if he's gay, why are they so exuberant? Why can't they be like more modest, right? Or why does a gay man would like to use a skirt? And I was just like, and I'm just like, how does this impact your life, your day-to-day life? Like, let people express and wear whatever they like. It's beautiful, it's different, like the more the merrier, right?
Yeah.
One thing about bodily autonomy, I don't know if I already told you this, but like a few years back, I think like 2 or 3 years ago, I read in the Guardian that Scottish men, when they use the kilts, they are assaulted by women, especially tourist women coming from the United States, like lifting their kilts. Basically, I'm just like, this is bananas. I think like they basically passed a law criminalizing people, women who do this. I was just like, poor man, but at the same time, you are feeling what women feel. So,
yes. But I mean, it's great that they kind of brought up a law for that. Yeah. Because I mean, but I mean, it's also insane because I mean, how many women face this centuries, and there's no law against. Yes. Now there's, I think, some laws about for upskirting, like this, where they just film underneath the skirt or of people in general. But I mean, how long did it take this, and if it happened, there's a law. Yeah, but also
but that's why I thought it was funny, because like when a man happens to go through the same thing as women, they will resolve this like quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that I've shared with you like an essay, I think from Gloria Steinem.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was her. If men would menstruate, it's like mm-hmm. the perfect example for it, right?
Yes. But yeah. And I mean, bodily autonomy also starts in this, like, I mean, we talked a lot about this kind of sexualized touching or being kind of an abusive touching, but I think it already starts in, especially, for example, for people of color, that people just touch their hair without asking.
Super strange. That's something that is super strange.
Yes.
I never thought that that could happen, but it does happen.
Yeah, or like,
I
don't know.
If I was on the street and I would touch your hair and your hair is straight, would you feel that like that's weird?
Of course, I would. I don't know. Probably reacted, or maybe just stare at you because I wouldn't believe that. Why are you touching my hair? For what reason?
Yeah,
but yeah,
it's like why people? Like, why?
But then, it's a bit out of the topic, but sometimes I'm also thinking, for example, I mean, my grandma was really like an expert in it, just touching children, as you said from the beginning of your story, no, just touching children and also just touching dogs on the street without asking for permission. I mean, you should also kind of ask the dog with body language for permission, but also like the owner, if it's okay or not to touch someone's dog.
That's super dangerous because you never know if a dog is going to bite you. So
yeah. So I feel like we have to learn a lot about this automatism of just touching something or not, or like just object. It's kind of an objectification of beings, no? That you can just, you have the power of touching someone or going into the private space.
And regarding touch, because I'm going to ask you this because you've been brought up in Germany, but you have this experience in Portugal. Do you see a difference, a cultural difference regarding touch between the two countries?
I mean, I think it's a bit difficult to say because I grew up in the west of Germany, which is perceived or known for a bit more being more open and in general a bit more friendlier. I mean, maybe a lot of regions say that, but I think because especially in Cologne, it's like they have a different mentality sometimes. So I'm also used to this more being more open if you approach new people and talking to people. But in a sense of touch, I don't know. I think like more elderly people, but it's the same in Germany that elderly people tend to touch you more. But I wouldn't say, for me, it's more like what is the difference is like that you get more catcalled or like the stares, like this obvious stares from all people. It's more obvious and not that much hidden as I, in my experience, had it in Germany, for example. But could you make a difference? I mean, yeah, could you say, I mean, of course, you grew up in Portugal, but would you have expected that there would be a difference?
Yeah. Because I deal with normally a lot of people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So a few years back, I had this experience actually in Germany, in Berlin, when I've met a new person and automatically I went to give like two kisses on the cheek normal thing. And she was just like, oh yeah, I'm sorry that I was so awkward with that because we in Germany normally tend to like shake hands. No, you don't have to like apologize for that. Like you are on the right and I'm on the wrong. Because I automatically did this. So from that experience that I've never in my mind linked the two of them, like from a body autonomy perspective, I started to ask people when I know, so are you a handshaker, a hugger, or like a waver? Like my first approach, I think that the first time that we've met, I've asked you this, right? It came from that experience.
Yep.
I prefer one thing I've learned from that experience when I was younger. I never let parents force children to kiss me.
Mm-hmm.
Never, because I had that like bad experience when I was younger. So I never, when people say, go kiss Katarina. No. He just needs to acknowledge me if he wants to kiss me, to hug me, or it's up to them. And it's fine. And like I like to call them little people, like to hang out with me because I like to watch cartoons with them and play with them and read books and stuff like that. But they sometimes are super cuddly and friendly, and that's fine because it's their like choice. But I never thought from like adult point of view, because for me culturally this was super ingrained. So I was not like in a a business setting. In a business setting, mm-hmm. of course, I would never dare to kiss like somebody in the face like for the first time. And of course, that's like in the private life, in my private life, of course, that needs to also mm-hmm. to also be there. That's why I like from that like experience, yeah. of course, are okay. you a hugger, a kisser, or a waver? It's like, that's yep. that's fine.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't thought about like this, for example, cultural greetings, how you used to greet in your culture. And I mean, like in Germany, it's more a formal way. If you don't know the person, you're always more like with distance, shake your hands or not even shaking your hands. And then if you get to know a person, you're more like you tend to hug or whatever. But yeah, that's interesting. But then I'm also thinking like, I mean, it's a very nice way to ask like, are you a kisser, a hugger, whatever, a handshaker? But then I'm also thinking, I mean, because I think it gets more complicated because I didn't thought about it when you asked me. And now when you talked about it, I was like, yeah, sure. And I think it gets more difficult because the societies we are living in are getting more and more diverse. Before, you didn't have to ask that because it was quite, I quote this, normal to hug someone because you learn it in your cultural background or your environment. And now a lot of different cultural environments come together and different habits, which is super beautiful, but can be also quite confusing and for some overwhelming. But so it's a very nice way to ask.
And it's the same. So a few years back, I had my yoga teacher training. And one thing I've learned is that for you to teach yoga, you don't need to touch people. Mm-hmm. You can align a person, you can ask a person if we can touch her, but if the person is not comfortable, you know techniques on how to explain people to align themselves in mm-hmm. a yoga pose without touching them. So in my mind, if we can do this like in a discipline who works so much with the body, mm-hmm. with aligning the body, you can do that with other disciplines, other sports. You don't need to be touched and like handled by your trainers
yeah.
in order to for them to teach you whatever it is,
or kind of ask for permission before the lesson, and then but also that giving the space to take back your permission because you don't feel and say like yes. And it should be more, you should be comfortable enough to say like, I don't feel comfortable in the moment, so please don't touch. Or you can touch my arms or my upper body part, but please don't touch my belly and my legs without reasoning or without having to explain yourself. So just that it's more,
because we never know what's behind it, right? Yeah. It can be self-esteem issues, it can be like trauma related fears, etc. So I know that people want to be friendly and want to help and want to do all of those stuff, but I think that we need to introduce this concept of body autonomy in our day-to-day lives in a way that makes other people feel at ease with you, right? Like, that's good manners, basically. Being polite and having good manners, it's respecting other people. And mm-hmm. respecting other people, it's giving them the body autonomy that they need, right? And we are just talking from a social point of view, right? Mm-hmm. Like the kissing and the touching and the hugging and all of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, but I think also like how you give care to known people, but also to strangers on the street, or to not just give support and give help, more like if to ask the person what kind of help, I mean, do you want help, and if what kind of help do you need in very close relationships, but also in kind of your daily life when you want to help someone in the street, to ask them, how can I help you, if they want to be helped.
Yeah.
Yep.
Are you ready the next segment.
Yes. You want to start?
No. You start.
Okay. Okay, let's see what you are bringing, because I was hoping you bring my first choice. So I brought another choice. So let's see if...
You have to present the segment first.
Yes. Okay. So the segment is Reflect and Connect, where we bring any kind of references, literature, movies, whatever resources we came across, and connect, for example, to the topic of the episode, which is today the bodily autonomy. And we always bring something into the episode to kind of suggest, or at least just connect it to the topic. And I brought today, I think it's a quite known thing and it's quite popular, but still it's a very, very good one and portrays how easily bodily autonomy and the right to choose about your body gets refused and is taken from you. So I brought The Handmaid's Tale from Margaret Atwood, which is in a lot of formats. I read all the books. There are comics about it. There's even a series about it, which I partly watched and then I stopped because at one point...
Super heavy.
Yeah, and it got super dramatic and not... I don't know, it was a bit over, how do you say, overproduced a bit. But like the beginning is very good, but very, very heavy. So also a big disclaimer, I mean, it's a lot about sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and it portrays how society takes all the rights from women and categorizes them in duties of reproduction of the household, or just the being the wife, which is not being able to reproduce somehow. So it's a really, really good books, good comics, and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. You. Yeah. That was my choice also.
Yeah.
That was also my choice, but that's fine.
Yeah.
From the top of my mind, let's see. You have some interesting essays that are really accessible for the majority of people. And with this, I'm not saying people are dumb, but it's not super heavy on academia. It's called The Feminists Don't Wear Pink. And you have some essays there on also that discuss all of this, like... abortion rights and all of that. So, yeah. But The Handmaid, yeah,
you are
on the spot. That's like, it's perfect. It's perfect.
Yes. And first I thought you might bring the new book from Gillian.
Wand? Yes.
Wand.
No, I did not bring it because I did not start it to read.
Okay.
And I don't like to recommend things that I don't like. I haven't read it or haven't seen it, but yes, Margaret Atwood is like,
but I think
that I've seen her some like a comment when a recent comment of hers that she stated like that's nowadays, especially in the US, things are getting strangely weird and really close to the book, and I'm just like, yes, you were a visionary.
Yeah, in all of her books, like I read a lot of books of her, and she's amazing. And I think it's a good reminder of how we have to stay active, fight for rights and maintain rights, and then also see for whom the rights are made, and then how we can expand and include more and more people in having these rights and legal protection. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay.
You can close the episode.
No, it was a pleasure. It was a really nice conversation.
Of course, also.
I hope the listeners will enjoy as well, and we hope to see you in the next episode.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Intersectionality Lab. If some terms or topics made you curious, check out our website. Maybe some of the resources will keep your thoughts rolling. Meet us where the lines cross. We are a non-profit research center working on human rights, gender equality, and active citizenship. And this podcast was created with the support of our team.